There were instances where citizens were known to disagree with MacArthur or with the administration's policy without being accused of treason. Until more evidence is in, all that can be said has already been said several times. Some editors blew their tops, others remained steady. In the course of our unscientific survey of the press, we encountered the Dahlonega Nugget, the gold of the news, a weekly paper published in Dahlonega, Georgia. The Bloodmobile will be there Wednesday. A byline piece by Mary Abercrombie informs us that a whippoorwill was heard at Upper Wahoo Sunday night. But we were interested in editorial comment. Editor Jack Parks of the Dahlonega Nugget led his column with these words.
We had planned to write a thunderous editorial this week on the firing of General MacArthur, but we regret to report that news from Yahula and Frogtown, plus other disturbances in and around Dahlonega, have crowded the general off the front page of the Nugget. If anyone is interested in getting our views on the MacArthur issue, they may secure same by calling on us at our offices in the Nugget Tower.
You are listening to Hear It Now, CBS's weekly document for air based on the week's news. The program continues immediately after this pause for station identification. This is CBS, the Columbia Broadcasting System.
WDWS, AM and FM, Champaign, Urbana. Keep up to par, wear an airman jacket. Airman jackets are styled right for golfing comfort. Their raglan sleeves give you plenty of room, freedom of movement for teeing and stroking on the green. You'll find airman jackets at Pat Kane's, 202 North Neal, Champaign, in sizes 36 to 46, in six handsome colors. They're priced at just $5.50. Airman jackets at Pat Kane's.
Program 20 on Hear It Now, a full-hour review of the week's news, told in the actual recorded voices of the men and women who make the news. Once again, here is the editor of Hear It Now, Edward R. Murrow.
There was a once familiar sound, not often heard in recent years, in the news this week. The Mississippi was overflowing its banks again, in one of the worst floods in many years.
We're traveling down the Mississippi today, scene of the greatest flood since the 1880s. The great and awful damage caused by this river is very clear. We're over Dubuque, Iowa, where the river crested this morning at 22 and 7,400 feet. Water's creeping in on the streets and the railroad tracks. Streets going along in orderly fashion, as streets should. Then suddenly they vanish beneath the shallow, flooding waters of the Mississippi.
Your reporter is Dick Cheverton of station WMT, Cedar Rapids, Iowa, as he ranged over the swollen river in his special plane. This report was made on Monday. Since then, the crest of the river has risen. But amazingly, there have been almost no deaths from the flood. The plane, as it nears Cibola.
Below us, a pair of bright green barges and a towboat are nested along the shore, riding out the flood. Floodgates are up on the government dams. There's no attempt to hold back the water. Downriver, as we approach Cibola, it's almost too small to see. Cibola today, little battleship island, completely surrounded by water.
Altogether, more than 7,400 went homeless, with some 24,000 persons prepared to evacuate if the rains continue.
At Savannah, across the river, five grain elevators have wet feet. The railroad snakes across this river, its roadbed under. The tracks, double line of contact with drier civilization. Farther down the river, here at Davenport, the municipal stadium is wet. Along the first baseline, the field ends and the river begins. The oil storage tanks are like marshmallows floating on a thick, gummy chocolate syrup. Water's lapping at the threshold of the Lend-A-Hand. The ferry landing is no more.
The Mississippi is on its annual rampage, spring 1951, still unchecked by all the great engineering strides in flood control. But as of tonight, the rains have stopped. The waters, though not receding, are no higher. The worst seems over. War mobilizer Charles E. Wilson returned from an extensive inspection of the nation's production centers, including Wright Field at Dayton, Ohio. Mr. Wilson will leave shortly for conferences with General Eisenhower in Paris. He spoke last night to the newspaper publishers' convention in New York. Mr. Wilson.
I can only wish that you had been with me to share with me the warm glow of pride I felt in our American genius of design, development, and production. I can only wish, too, that a certain mustachioed gentleman from Moscow might have been with us. Perhaps he might then begin to cut his ambitions down to size. Since the first of this year, orders have been placed at the rate of $1 billion a week and more. The end of 1953, we will be able to meet the demands of all-out war, if need be, and God forbid, out of our production lines. Then, if any aggressor wants to tangle with us, he would have to be crazy.
One of America's mighty war weapons is already on hand, the B-36 heavy bomber. The plane that the Air Force calls the fastest, longest-ranging, highest-flying, greatest carrier of the greatest quantity of high explosives of any airplane in the world today. The B-36 is a controversial aircraft. The Congress has devoted many hours to hearing arguments by its friends and domestic enemies. But it's the biggest thing of its type we have. For the next few minutes of this program, we will take you on a B-36 flight from Carswell Air Force Base in Texas, thousands of miles around this country in Canada, and back to Carswell. It's a training mission, the type that hundreds of these planes carry out, unknown to most of us. The Strategic Air Command calls it a simulated mission, and we will simulate a mission for you tonight. In 20 minutes, we will take you on a 36-hour flight. The air rules for this flight are simple. Strategic Air Command permits no civilians in its B-36, but we were permitted to place our recorder in the plane. Now, to Carswell Air Force Base, 20 minutes from downtown Fort Worth in Texas.
This is a general briefing by the 7th Bomb Wing, directing that the 436 Bomb Squadron crew fly simulated high-altitude mission on target at Eglin Field, Florida. Takeoff time will be 0700, climbing en route to 10,000 feet.
You are listening to a briefing of pilots of the 8th Air Force, 7th Bomb Wing. Its mission is to organize and train a force capable of immediate and sustained long-range offensive operations in any part of the world. The order has come from Strategic Air Command headquarters for a special mission. It was transmitted to Carswell by teletype. After the pilots have been briefed, there will be special briefings on communications, weather, and then, on the ramp near the runway, the aircraft commander will call his crew together and explain it again.
Okay, let's gather around for this briefing. We'll take off from here, go to New York, to Earlton, Canada, to Point X in Canada. Then we'll proceed to Denver, Mobile Point, for an RBS run on Eglin Field. Then we'll return to Fort Worth. We'll climb out here to 10,000 feet, and for the first portion of the flight, we'll be at 35,000 feet over Eglin. Standard emergency procedures will hold. There'll be three short rings on the alarm bell to alert you, one long ring and a verbal command for execution. There'll be six short rings for a crash landing with one long ring just before impact. Does anyone have any questions?
The crew of this 436 heavy bomber squadron plane now knows its target for 36 hours later. 16 men climb into the plane, the aircraft commander and the pilot and the co-pilot. Each man can and does fly the plane. There are two flight engineers, two radio operators, five gunners, who are also called scanners, because when not in combat, they scan the engines for oil leaks, loose cowlings, and flap positions. We also have four observers, each qualified to work radar, navigate, or handle the bomb site. The crewmen are now settled in their positions. The ground crew has completed its endless checking and testing. Ground power generators are on, and we're ready to start the motors. And the ground crew chief takes over.
Sergeant Rock, will you get the headset, throat mic? Sergeant Nall, you and PFC Philby get the fire extinguisher. Sergeant Welland, you get the left wing and I'll get the right wing. Watch the engine whenever it starts. Notify the pilot or flight engineer when anything happens.
Inside and outside your B-36, checks are continuing. More than 600 items in all will have to be checked before takeoff. And when the technical details on this $3.5 million aircraft are all set and the aircraft commander talks to his crew, there are more than 27 miles of wire in this airplane, much of it used for communications from the pilot up front through every crew member to the rear gunner, 130 feet back. The clicks you will hear come from the intercom system. Everyone wears a throat mic, two black buttons strapped to his throat. When you press the button, you're talking to everyone in the plane. Now the pilot checks the alarm bell, the phone system, the oxygen equipment of his crewmen.
Pilot to crew, give me alarm bell, oxygen interphone check, please.
Navigator's interphone, alarm bell okay, oxygen 400 pounds.
Radar alarm bell interphone okay, oxygen 400 pounds.
Co-pilot alarm bell and interphone okay, oxygen 400 pounds.
Engineer alarm bell interphone okay, oxygen 400 pounds.
Radio interphone.
You have 10 engines on your plane, 6 reciprocating piston-type engines and 4 jets. They give you 42,000 horsepower, the equivalent of 9 locomotives pulling streamlined trains at top speed, as much power as 400 average passenger automobiles can generate. But you don't just flick a switch and take off. It takes time, and there's endless checking to be done.
Aye, Roger. Stand by for engine start. Engineer, you ready to start engines?
Aye, right, sir. Checklist complete. Ready to start engines.
Okay, pilot checklist complete. Brakes are set. You're clear to start.
Now the emergency switch on. Brakes on. Props normal.
Aye, Roger.
Engineer to ground, over.
Go ahead.
All air plugs and intercoolers open.
Roger.
All the props clear?
Props clear.
Okay, starting number 4.
Roger, all clear.
We're starting it now.
Roger, number 4, drive. Sweat.
This is the power of the plane that can fly 10,000 miles and drop 10,000 pounds of bomb halfway and reach an altitude of 45,000 feet, 8.5 miles in the air.
Roger.
Number 6 clear.
Roger. It's all clear.
Okay, starting 6.
Running dry.
You're almost ready to go now, but you need a check from the tower, instructions. And you'll need your 4 jets to help you take off, and later to give you additional speed.
Co-pilot, would you check flight controls while I contact tower for taxi instructions? Carswell Tower, this is 2658, over.
Airport 2658, Carswell Tower.
Tower 2658, request taxi takeoff instruction, please.
658 Carswell Tower, advise traffic north on 35 left, altimeter setting 2977. Surface winds are northeast at 6, clear to taxi, over.
Roger, thank you, 2658. Pilot crew, stand by to taxi. Engineer, are you ready to taxi?
All right, sir, ready to taxi.
Scanners, we have fire truck back of us now.
Roger, sir, we have fire truck.
Okay, Fred, you can start jet engine J1.
Roger, starting J1.
When all 4 of your jets are stabilized, you pull up on the long runway, 1.5 miles long, 100 yards wide. Halfway down that runway, our microphone is open, ready to record the sound of your 10 engines as you pull up to it, pass it, and get off the ground to start a practice mission of thousands of miles, a mission that will keep you in the air for 36 hours. Your 42,000 horsepower is pushing you into the air. Your plane weighs 358,000 pounds. From wingtip to wingtip, she measures 230 feet. That's longer than the distance covered by the Wright brothers' first airplane flight. And inside her bomb bay, when the time comes for her to fly in anger, she can carry more than 5 tons of explosives, or the atomic bomb, and reach a top speed of over 400 miles an hour. Your B-36 is airborne now. Carswell Air Base and our microphones are far behind on the runway. Now, we go back to the airplane and the crew.
Okay, we'll climb up here to about 10,000 for the first leg and level off there. Radar pilot. There's radar, go ahead. How's the set looking? Oh, it's looking pretty good, Chris. Looks pretty good. Looks like we might make some money today.
In a few hours, you're over Indiana at cruising speed.
Left scanner, this pilot.
Go ahead, sir.
Didn't you tell me once your home was in Evansville?
Roger, sir.
We'll be coming up there in about 5 minutes. The weather looks pretty good. You might be able to see it.
Roger, sir.
I heard that was a good place to be from.
Yeah, from.
Time passes slowly on these training missions. There are 6 bunks in the rear of the plane when your time comes to go off duty.